Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey friends, welcome to another episode of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. And we have just wrapped up Indian Wells, the first phase of the Sunshine Double in March. And it's a pretty big event on the calendar. And I happened to go there for 2 days as well in person. So that was a great experience. But joining me to recap it all, as we're done with both the men's and women's singles finals today. And it's officially complete. But here joining me is my good friend Owen. How are you doing today, Owen?
I'm good. I'm sorry I've been away for such a long time. This is like the first one I've done in what feels like forever. But I've been in Australia for some study abroad. And so that has made it difficult with the time change. But yeah, excited to be back and breaking down Indian Wells.
Yeah, great. It's great to have you back on this podcast after quite a few weeks off. And I'm sure you're enjoying your time in Australia.
Yeah, it's been great.
But yeah, let's get right into it. So obviously, let's start with the men's. Let's start with Carlos Alcaraz. You know, he won all six matches here, didn't drop a set, and absolutely that final. I mean, just the amount of options this kid has to win points, and the way he's going about his career right now. I mean, it's just so impressive to watch.
Yeah, I don't know how you're supposed to beat him right now, to be honest. I mean, before the final, I was thinking, like, you know, Medvedev defends so well, just covers the court like a blanket. He has that wingspan. And in the past, like, you can kind of make Alcaraz rush sometimes. So maybe Alcaraz is going to get frustrated. He can't hit through Medvedev on the slow court, and he'll make a billion errors. As we know, that is not what happens. He destroyed Medvedev. Who was on like a 19 match winning streak? Is that right?
Yep, 19 matches, 3 titles. Like, you know,
yeah,
3 different time zones, and
right. Yeah. And I mean, not that we needed this match to prove this, but like, this was pretty clear cut proof that like Alcaraz is a better player than Medvedev. He's got a better forehand. He probably defends as well. I think he's probably a better aggressive returner. He gets more pace on the backhand. He's got way better touch. And he just has more ways to win points. Like when you see Medvedev returning from way back, he'll hit the crap out of a forehand, but Alcaraz is so nimble that he can just hit a stretch volley, even if Medvedev's return has a good angle on it. And yeah, Medvedev just didn't really seem to have any ideas after Alcaraz showed he could win. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, how do you beat him, Bonch? Do you have any theories?
Well, you know, coming into this match, I thought the same as you. I thought, you know, Medvedev's shot tolerance, his ability to absorb all the pace, the way he can defend, you know, almost Djokovic-esque when he's in this kind of a mode,
yeah,
on this kind of a hot streak. I thought, okay, you know, we might see Alcaraz just kind of being himself for a few games, like he did, let's say, in the first set against Sinner, where he was a little patchy for 3 or 4 games in a row and eventually, you know, pulled off some amazing shots in the tiebreak and then managed to win that one in straights. But I just felt like, you know, It was gonna be impossible once I saw the first 3 games of this match, and Alcaraz quickly went up 3-0 and he just broke right away. It's almost like Medvedev's belief was just gone completely. I mean, he just broke Medvedev's will, because here he was doing what he normally does, you know, stands way back on the return, tries to get, you know, gets it really deep, and then, you know, forces you to, you know, go for extra on your ground strokes and just like go for lines and, you know, play in a manner that's disruptive and unconventional. Like, that's how you have to be to beat him. And Alcaraz was just playing within himself, and he was playing with a lot more patience than I've seen him play in the past. You know, in the past, he might have gotten a bit too trigger happy earlier in the rallies, might have been a little bit too ambitious, going for shots that, are amazing and he can obviously pull off, but that also comes with stretches of unforced errors. But in this match, he was going backhand to backhand with Medvedev, and very patiently as well, and then looking for the moment to pull the drop shot, then looking for the moment to come in and sneak in on do a nice drop volley, and then he's so good in the forecourt, and it's not just that he's good, but he just knows exactly when to come forward and when to deploy which shot at the right time. And the drop shot, he used it perfectly, like exactly. He went into the match with like a clear cut plan, and he executed it pretty much perfectly.
I think this is probably the main thing that makes Alvarez so hard to play. It's like he's having a moment with the drop shot. Like he's just figured out that he can make it work because he hits the ball so heavy, so fast from the baseline. So you have to back up to give yourself time to defend. But then that creates all the space for the drop shot, and you literally cannot cover both. Like you have a Medvedev who backs up, like, and he's going to defend really well. But like if you're 10 feet behind the baseline, you can't get to the drop shot. At the same time, Medvedev can't really change plans because Medvedev is not someone who can stand glued to the baseline and half volley his ground strokes deep like Djokovic. So you kind of have to give Alcaraz like one or the other. And if Alcaraz is on his game, then like you're kind of screwed either way. I really don't know what you do, because like talking about Djokovic again, I really think that's the one way you can kind of maybe blunt Alcaraz's game a little bit, which is like stand in close, take everything on the rise, and that way you can sort of redirect his pace and get in closer so that you don't have to run as far for the drop shot. But even Djokovic, when they played in Madrid, Alcaraz like destroyed him with the drop shot. I think he won like 15 out of 20 points with it. And so like if that's how it works against Djokovic, like I don't think anyone else has a chance to really take that away from him. I don't know. I think it's a pretty terrifying proposition for any opponent at this point.
Yeah, and last year this time we sat in here and we tried to look for holes in his game, We tried to see, okay, is there anything else that, that maybe he can get? Because Ferrero says after the US Open that he's at 60% of his peak, which if that's the case, that is freaking scary for everyone. But like, and we thought, okay, maybe the serve. He can get a few more, he can up the miles per hour. He can definitely improve the placement. He can get a few more free points behind it, make his life a little easier so he's not having to work so hard. Well, guess what? In this tournament, he did that, His average first serve speed went way up in the center match. By way up, I mean 7 or 8 miles per hour. But that, as you know, that makes a big deal in these conditions. And I feel like he was the only one all week who could hit through these courts. And like hit through them he did. And then on top of that, how do you get the ball by him? Because his speed is just outrageous. His speed, anticipation, like his flexibility, like on the stretch, like, and then, that one point that he played against Sinner, where he just basically, he went back and then he hit that ridiculous lob, and then, he makes it look so easy. He does the like backhand overhead, and then Sinner comes in and actually hits a pretty good slice, like pretty deep, And
yeah, right on the line too.
Yeah, like pretty much on the back of the line. And then Alcaraz hits this Andy Murray-esque lob, and it just goes so far deep. And you're thinking, okay, surely this is out, but nope, it just catches the back of the line too. And it's like, this is brutal. And, it's important that he beat Felix, he beat Sinner, he beat Medvedev, and he beat these guys pretty comfortably. Like, these were not, super competitive matches at the end of the day.
Right, talking about his serve, Medvedev, who is one of the best returners on tour, won 12 points on the return in the entire match. And zero break balls. So, the serve can get better, but like if it's already doing that on a slow court, like maybe it doesn't need to get that much better. And also, since everything else is so outrageously good, it's like it's not like anyone exactly exposes his serve, right? Like, when was the last time we saw someone like break him at will? Like, I don't know. Like, I can't really think of a great example. Like, again, when he played Djokovic, and I think the conditions helped with this because it was in Madrid, so you get the altitude and everything. Djokovic broke him once in like this really, really long match. So, like, sort of like you said, like I do think the serve can get better, but he knows how to cover that weakness and even work it to his advantage so well already that it's, I don't know. I don't know what you do against him.
Yeah, he's one of those players that's just going to keep on, because he has so many of the tools. He has all the tools already. So it's like it's just a matter of like shot selection, decision making, like discipline. I feel like it's just about discipline, because when he's, you know, when he's like locked in and in this kind of mode where there's really no one in the world that can hang with him from a speed and power standpoint, I feel like it, just the combination of his speed and power and touch, I think it's the only one who can really challenge it is the form we saw from Djokovic in Australia.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting to see when he's back in the clay court season in Monte Carlo or somewhere in Madrid and Rome. If these two do play each other, what does Djokovic do differently from the Madrid match?
It's a great question. And like, I mean, I probably shouldn't be saying this about Djokovic, who, you know, I think is the best ever to do it, and has like game plan A, B, C all the way through Z. But like, I don't know that there is a lot that he can do differently. I think some people forget that in that Madrid match, Djokovic basically played him perfectly in the first set. He kept Alcaraz on the run constantly, so much so that Djokovic was actually hitting the ball harder on average than Alcaraz, because Alcaraz was having to hit everything on the run. And I remember watching that and thinking, okay, this is how you beat him. Like, Djokovic has figured out the game plan. But then as the match wore on, Alcaraz kind of figured him out and started doing a better job of dictating points, started hitting more drop shots, and Djokovic wasn't able to get out of that jail. And so I almost wonder if Alcaraz has the momentum in that rivalry now, even though they've only played one match and Djokovic was still in the middle of his comeback. If they're to play on clay again, I would favor Alcaraz.
Yeah, and he has so many more points to gain during the clay court season as well, because he also lost early in Monte Carlo, didn't play Rome, and he kind of hit himself off the court in the first two sets against Zverev and Roland Garros, and he wasn't able to come back there. So, and he looks pretty healthy now. Like, you know, remember how we were like kind of concerned about him, like physically?
Yeah.
Like after the Nori match, which in hindsight, it's like, how did he even get that close in that match? Because he was so clearly injured, he could barely even walk in between points, and then... Mm-hmm. You know, he started, even in that match, he showed like his absolute genius by getting it to 7-5 in the third.
Yeah.
Nori had to play almost perfectly. That's the only match he's lost this year, and he's played three tournaments. He's made the finals of all three. Like, yeah, it's just amazing that he can take like 3-4 months off and just come back at this level and look pretty much better than ever. And I do actually think a slow hard court is probably his best surface.
Okay, interesting.
You know, just because. On the clay, you know, you're still slipping and sliding, and he might be a little out of position movement wise, and then, you know, he can get more out of the serve, and he can hit through courts like this because he has the requisite power of both wings to, like, I mean, he was literally rushing Daniel Medvedev, like,
yeah, that's true.
You don't actually do that, like, it's not
right.
Like, you know, even your average top five player doesn't rush Daniel Medvedev on his backhand, like it's really hard to do.
In Dubai, we saw Djokovic try to do that by like hitting the crap out of every ball, and that was a fast hard court.
I know he was getting help from the court, but even then it was difficult. Like, it's
I mean, shifting gears a little to talk about Medvedev, what are your thoughts on him? Because I think he's obviously had this amazing winning streak, but I think it's hard not to look at this last match, and maybe you can tell me this a little better about his serve. I was telling you before we started recording, I slept through most of this match and just like tuned in at the end, and I've like caught up where I can since. But, you know, zero aces, two double faults. Seems like he didn't play that well, and I think a lot of that is down to the matchup. But like, what do you think this means for him? Obviously, this is going to be a tough matchup going forward.
Yeah, I think the matchup is clearly going to be tough because you can throw the one that they played at Wimbledon out the window. That was a completely different Alcaraz almost 2 years ago. But I think it was a very good week for him, like, just to get to the final, just because, you know, he looked completely down and out in the Zverev match. I think that was in the fourth round, and he was down.
Yeah,
you know, he lost the first set, and then he rolled his ankle, break point down in the second, and it looked like his Indian Wells was pretty much done. I mean, he was complaining about the courts and other slow courts, and, you know, I can't believe that they're hard. It's not hard courts. You're lying to me, you know, and this is, you know. We know all of the memeable stuff that he did there, but like once he got through that match, he actually started playing more aggressive. And he started getting more out of his serve, and he did that very well. In his next few matches, particularly the Tiafoe win and the Fokina match in the quarters, but in this match, I just felt like Alcaraz is such a good returner, much better than those players that I just listed, and so he was getting nothing. I mean, I don't think I have to look at the unreturned stats, but I'd be shocked if he won more than 7 or 8 points on unreturned serves. And that's like usually how he beats you, because you know, with that easy offense that he has with his serve, then that just frees up the rest of his game and he can just go wall mode from the baseline. But in this match, he has no weapons to hurt Alcaraz with from the, you know, like just when you take away the serve, I feel like, you know, because his backhand is basically pace absorbing, redirecting, cannot miss. And then his forehand is basically like, that's the one that decides how well Daniil Medvedev plays. Like if he's injecting pace in his forehand and he's absolutely like, you know, taking big cuts and doing more than just redirecting, then he usually makes a headway. The thing is, how does he make headway on a slow court against Alcaraz? You know, with that kind of a, you know, backswing and just like just the way he produces his power, like it's just, you know, unless he's coming to the net and then finishing off points, which was really difficult for him in this match. He was not comfortable up there. Even when he tried to, I think he tried to come in as a changeup. I actually like his backhand volley a little bit more than his forehand one. I think his forehand one is just a bit off technically completely. And then his backhand, sometimes he can finesse it and make it work. Because he can get down low and sometimes, you know, it just, like, he'll surprise you and hit a really good one. But in this match, there was just no easy points for him. Like, just none. And on top of that, he made more unforced errors. Like, I mean, you know, you can see he hit four winners. It took him until the sixth game of the match to hit a winner off the ground. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, and he hit zero aces too. So,
yeah, first time in years that's happened to him on in a match, I think. But I mean, that unforced error set is it right there, right? Like, if you're not the most powerful player, then you have to be more consistent. So it's
I mean, he was almost trying to play overly offensive because he knew his normal, you know, pace absorbing game from the baseline wasn't going to do enough. So he was overplaying. He was actually like overhitting on his forehand, like trying to do way too much, and he was hitting it wide most of the time, which is like. Yeah, which means he's just pressing and struggling to really, and he couldn't really turn it around. Like it was the match flew by in such a quick way that he just, I mean, Alcaraz was rolling through his service games and he was barely losing points on his first serve. And there were times where he was going way out in the outside, like almost, you know, the thing that he does, which is like close to the doubles alley, and then he does the extreme kick serve. Medvedev's back, and I thought that wasn't going to work against Medvedev because he stands so far back. That he was just going to be able to time the ball really well and maybe even hit it down the line for a winner. But he just set up his next forehand and it was just business as usual. And I was like, okay, like he has that in his back too. So,
yes.
And it felt like a total mismatch.
Right. And like before we move on to the women's final, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. I feel like they're very different types of baseliners and that, like, you know how there are players where if you get back a deep return, you maybe haven't won the point already, but you're close. Like against a serve bot, you get back a deep return and it's like, okay, you've got like what, a 70-80% chance of winning the point now. But then you also have players, and I think Alcaraz is in this camp, where like if you get back a decent return, it doesn't mean all that much really. Like if you get back an aggressive return and put him on the run, that helps. But I feel like even if Medvedev gets the ball back to Alcaraz's feet, Alcaraz can like half volley it, and then in a neutral rally, it's just a matter of time before he goes on the attack again. I kind of think the same thing about Djokovic. Like when you have great defenders who are also powerful, even if you hit a deep return, like it's not enough offense, if that makes sense. But I think against Medvedev, if you can kind of put him on the back foot, then you're going to be moving from corner to corner pretty soon. And so I think in that way, like Alcaraz probably got more out of his deep returns than Medvedev, if that makes sense. I don't know if I phrased that coherently.
I understand what you're saying, like because Alcaraz also has the half volley and then he also has the drop shot if it's even a little bit short. So, and the thing is that Medvedev didn't really adjust his return position, and when he did, he wasn't very successful because then his returns were landing short. And then when they land short, then Alcaraz has a million options and really only he will beat himself, and then you might be able to, like, Medvedev wasn't really able to coax errors the way he normally does, then the way he baits you into mistakes, you know, by just being more consistent than you and just, like, just having much better rally tolerance. Like, against Alcaraz, he just immediately took a rip at anything short, and it was just game over, because he has such good finishing skills in the forecourt, and that's what you need to beat Medvedev.
Like, I think a lot of the time, if you hit a mid-court return against Medvedev, that forehand is going to come back at you in that middle third or fourth. And against Alcaraz, it's immediately flying to the corner. That's a key difference, I think.
I also felt like all tournament, Alcaraz's backhand was really good. I mean, even in the Sinner match where I thought, okay, you know, Sinner might have the edge backhand to backhand. I mean, if it's just ground stroke, if they're just doing like target practice on ground strokes, you know, Sinner actually hits a pretty clean ball, like over both wings, and he might be able to win. But then when you take the explosiveness, you add the explosiveness and you add like the, you know, the genius, like lottery movement, or you add like the just the touch and the feel and everything else, that's where Alcaraz really separates himself, I feel like. And even in the backhand to backhand exchanges against Sinner, he was the one like being more offensive, you know?
Yeah,
Sinner was
that
doing a
set
good
point in
job
the
of
first set.
being
Yeah.
steady, but like the set point in the first set, I mean, he just ripped it. And that's kind of how he got the break against Medvedev in this match as well. It was a 95 mile per hour cross court backhand winner off of a pretty, you know, decent like return. It wasn't super short in the court or anything. It was fairly deep, like close to the back of the baseline. And he still just took it early, ripped it. And I don't know. It was
Yeah.
just so easy. It was so easy. So easy to be
It's
true.
not
Like,
something you can ever learn if you don't have that, I think. Like, Medvedev is
yeah.
never going to be able to do that. Most players on tour are never going to be able to do that. I can't wait to see what he does for the rest of the year. I don't know. I mean, he continues to impress you even when you know what he's capable of. And I think that's a pretty special thing to have in a player.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I just felt like it was just more efficient, a bit more disciplined, while still not losing the amazing shot making skills that he has and highlight reel abilities. So he was able to, and I feel like that's when he hits his perfect sweet spot. Because, yeah, because I mean, there were times last year where he was pretty stressed from Madrid to the US Open, and he was, you know, like not taking all his breakpoint chances. He was a bit erratic, a bit too trigger happy, but we knew that all the other tools were there. It was just, you know, was lacking experience, and now he actually has that under his belt, and now he only gets better from here. I think he'll only get better, and yeah. So it was a really good tournament for him, and then I think pretty positive tournament for Medvedev overall as well. Because even though he was complaining, you know, a lot of the time during the week, it didn't actually affect his level of play. He impressed me a lot in the Tiafoe match actually, because when he squandered
Yeah, me too.
those 7 or 8 match points, that was a perfect time for like Medvedev to melt down. I think in the past he probably would have, but he just moved on with it and then played a really good tiebreak. And
Yeah.
yeah, what did you think about the Tiafoe win?
I thought it was good. I mean, the end really impressed me because he had 40 love when he served for it.
Yeah,
Four
six
match points
five.
altogether. Yeah. And then when that goes to a tiebreak, like you've a lot of mental baggage. And he managed to win the tiebreak anyway. That impressed me. At the same time, you can see how much of a more comfortable matchup that is for Medvedev than the Alcaraz one. Like I have always rated Medvedev very highly in good matchups. So like I think on a hard court, he can play basically anyone except Djokovic and now Alcaraz, and maybe a couple others on their day. And if he's at his best, then he's going to look amazing. I think it's adjusting in those tougher matchups that's really going to be the test for him, because sort of like we've been talking about in this Alcaraz matchup, like what is he supposed to do? Like he tried adjusting, didn't really work. He's not one dimensional, but he can be made to look one dimensional by certain players. And I think when that happens, that's where he's really up against the wall. And I don't know if he's going to be able to get out of that situation.
That would be interesting to see though, because it would be interesting to see if he like gets back to the level that he showed before the final and continues to roll on in Miami, or maybe this hot streak kind of cools down a little bit and then, you know, maybe it resumes again later on the hard courts or after the clay season's over. It will be interesting to see, but he definitely proved that he can win matches on a slow court. Like, it's not, you know, it's not like let's completely write him off for the clay season, but it's also like, you know, let's be realistic about his chances. It's like kind of somewhere in between. Like, it's kind of hard to gauge, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, what else, like any other like kind of big takeaways like from the men's side before we move on to the women's?
I don't really think so. I mean, I think trying to think about the other players who went really deep. I think Nori having a good run, another good run was impressive. We can talk about Sinner a little bit. What did you think of his performance against Alcaraz?
Yeah, I thought he should have won the first set, if I'm being honest. Because, you know, 4-2, okay, Alcaraz was up 4-2, but from then on he really made a string of unforced errors and then won the next Sinner was able to win the next three games. And then he had a set point and he didn't really read the play very well. And I felt like there was some opportunity there for him to maybe take advantage of that Alcaraz lapse, and he didn't wasn't quite able to do it. I don't think he played badly in the tiebreak at all. He actually hit a couple of really impressive shots, but Alcaraz just one-upped him. And then in the second set, I think he'll have most regrets about his serving, because I don't think he served nearly as well as he could have. His first serve percentage was quite low, and wasn't really, the slow courts, it was just giving Alcaraz a lot more time, and it was lethal on return in the second set, especially. And he just handled the outer edges a lot better, like the finer parts of the forecourt, or like dealing with the drop shot slice. I think Sinner's drop shot retrieval was better when they played at the US Open.
Yeah.
And I think the overall quality of the match was definitely way higher at the US Open. But I mean, if this is considered a low quality match between these two, then I think we're going to have an amazing next 10 years. So I think overall he can be pretty pleased about his tournament, because the win against Fritz really impressed me more than the Alcaraz match, actually. But yeah, like I think overall he walks away from it feeling pretty good. But maybe he has some regrets about the tight moments in the Alcaraz match. What do you think?
I largely agree with that. I mean, I think, that set point in the first set, he had a good look at kind of a flick cross-court pass there, sent it down the line, Alcaraz read it. But I mean, at the end of the day, Alcaraz is just a little better, So I think it's hard to be too frustrated when someone who's a bit better than you beats you, right? Like, I think it's tempting to lump Sinner and Alcaraz in together. But look, like, Alcaraz has a major already. He's got three Masters 1000 titles.
It's not really close when it comes to winning the big titles right now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you can see it in the level, too, and kind of the way they handle certain matchups. Like, Medvedev is a killer matchup for Sinner. Like, Sinner's done a little bit better recently, but that's really difficult for him. Alcaraz just handled it like it was nothing. Sinner struggles against Tsitsipas. Tsitsipas's forehands does a lot in that matchup. Alcaraz has beaten Tsitsipas three times in a row. styles make matchups and everything, so it's not like matchups are everything, but I think you can sort of see the difference between them. Like, Alcaraz is just, I think, a little more ruthless. He's got a little bit faster. He's a little bit better touch, little more explosive, and across the board, that makes a big difference. So I still rate Sinner very highly. I think he's going to do a lot this year that he wasn't able to do last year, both because he's learned and because hopefully he won't get injured as much. Injuries got in his way a lot last year. But yeah, I mean, I think 7-6, 6-3 kind of is a good representation of where Alcaraz and Sinner are right now.
Yeah, I'd love to agree with that. I think Sinner has improved his serve, which is good. Good to see. Like, I think technically he's like changed up the motion a little bit. He's like cupping the racket a little bit and getting a faster extension, but it's so that helps him in terms of winning more free points. And I think the big thing is staying injury free. Like, he had so many small niggles last year where he just wasn't, like, his ranking didn't really reflect how well he played throughout the whole year. So I hope he's able to, like, just stay healthy and build on this and reverse some of those head-to-heads, because now he's actually got a couple more top five wins. I think that Fritz match, probably would have lost that last year or at some points early in his career. So he is, like, kind of making incremental improvements, but Alcaraz is just on a meteoric trajectory. So it's... but yeah, like you said, the matchups make kind of so compelling. So hopefully... Yeah, hopefully this will continue for Sinner and you won't get discouraged by this loss.
Yeah, and I do think that Sinner Alcaraz rivalry is still going to be great and everything. Like, I think one thing Sinner has on his side is, like, he is not intimidated at all by Alcaraz. And I think pretty much everyone else is. I mean, maybe not Djokovic, but I think Medvedev was. Sinner goes in there and he believes he can win. He believes he can go toe-to-toe with him, and he does. Like, we saw it for almost 5.5 hours at the U.S. Open. And, he lost this match in straights, but he hit a set point in the first set. So head-to-head is still 3-2. I think he's going to beat Alcaraz more in the future. So, yeah, I'm excited for him as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are largely the players that did well in the Indian Wells.
Yeah.
Pretty solid defense for Fritz, getting to the quarters and playing, getting his teeth into the center match where he was largely getting outplayed in long rallies for the most part, and you thought, okay, his serve really has to take over this match, and in the second set it kind of did. That's how he got back into it, and then just came down to in the game at 4-4 in the third after they traded breaks early, and Sinner just was a little better. So yeah, I think overall, and he was what, 5 in the world, and I think now he'll be 10, so I think
yeah
it seems about reasonable, I think.
Yeah, it was always going to be a tricky title defense, and he lost to a better player. So I think he'll be disappointed, but I don't think he should be frustrated, necessarily.
I actually thought Felix played a very good match against Alcaraz as well in the quarters, and that 4-4 score.
Yeah.
Might have been a bit brutal, because Felix was pulling off some incredible shots, too, and he was definitely...
And it wasn't even close to enough. Like, yeah. It's crazy how high the bar was in that match. Because, like you said, it was, like, great quality, but you could see Alcaraz was, like, levels above, really. And I think indoor conditions suit Felix way better. And this was more in Alcaraz's backyard, but still.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But yeah, should we talk about the women's side and talk about Rybakina, Sabalenka, and Iga, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to start with the final, I think... So, like, really exciting match, exciting scoreline. I think that first set tiebreak, like, speaks for itself. I guess the first question I had for you is, what role do you think the conditions played in this match? Because I was thinking the slower conditions probably helped Rybakina a little bit. Because when I was thinking back to their Australian Open final, what I remember from the second two sets in that match was Sabalenka hitting the ball so hard. And it was rushing Rybakina to the extent that it almost felt like she was getting knocked off her feet. And so I think it, and that was sort of when her forehand fell apart a little bit, just because it was being absolutely tortured by like these 90 mile an hour missiles from Sabalenka. And it seems like on a slower court, she was able to get a little bit more time. And that almost helped her, if not dictate, like stay in neutral rallies a little more.
Yeah, she definitely was able to stay in rallies a lot better than she was in Australia, where I felt like Sabalenka's defense and her ability to scramble and get balls back and kind of extend the rallies was going to help her. And especially like because she served so well in that match, Sabalenka, with all, you know, that entire tournament really. But like in that match, she had 17 aces and, you know, 7 double faults. And in this match, it kind of reverted a little bit back to Sabalenka. And that was a little sad to see because I think she had like 7 double faults before the first set tiebreak even began. And at that point, I think actually it was very tricky for Sabalenka in the wind. Like, there was one side of this court that was really, really windy, and Sabalenka was playing against the wind, so it was behind her back. And with that motion that sometimes, you know, those, I guess, issues can sometimes flare up on the serve, like the yips. So, like, when she was double faulting a lot on that side, like, she did very well to get a break in the first set, but then she immediately gave it back. Like, a couple of double faults, a couple of loose errors. And then Rybakina was ready. I just felt like Rybakina had such a steady level throughout for most of the match, and she was just dictating, like, she was hitting such clean strikes off of anything remotely attackable from Sabalenka's serve and our ground game. And Sabalenka was having to do a bit too much to make up the deficit of double faults, because I feel like that actually really got in her head. Like, when she was in the tiebreak, and it was a 13-11 tiebreak, and they both had, like, 5 set points. It was crazy. And every time one of them went up a mini break, and they had a set point on their serve, they made a first ball error after the serve. And it was just like, who wants to win this tiebreak? Because it was just so tense and so brutal. And it seems crazy that they were able to play some of their best tennis in a slam final. And then in this final, which is still a really big occasion and the conditions are very tricky, it was just like, who's going to not lose it versus who's going to take it? And at the end, I feel like Sabalenka's just like a couple too many loose errors And usually it came down to like, I think 6-5 in the tiebreak, she had a double fault. Like 8-7, she had another double fault. And these were all like once she's gotten the mini break. And once she lost that set, I was like, I don't care who you are, it's going to be impossible to like regroup after that. Because it was like an hour, 20 minute set in like brutal conditions. And now she has to serve again, starting the second set on the same side where she usually struggles with the wind. And then that's what happened. She got broken in the first game. And Rybakina, to her credit, like really raised her level even at the start of the second set. And she was just timing. She was hitting these forehand down the line returns off of wide serves from Sabalenka. And Rybakina, I think, is underrated at her ability to hit. Like when she's stretched in the outer thirds, I always thought like her defense isn't as good as Serena's. But when she times the ball, because she has such good reach, she's able to like really extend through and actually like use Sabalenka's pace. She did that so well, like to get. That's how she broke back in the first set and how she got the break in the second with that forehand return winner down the line most of the time.
She's a phenomenal returner. Like her thing at the Australian Open was just like torturing second serves. I remember I was at her semifinal with Azarenka. I think Azarenka was like 6-27 or something or like 3-21, something like that on second serve points won. In this match, it looks like on Google scores, Sabalenka won 44% of her second serve points. Rybakina won 59%. She's just absolutely ruthless as a returner and so unflappable mentally. I mean, she was down a break in that first set, down a bunch of set points. And like you said, she got some help from Sabalenka, but she's just like impossible to, I think, bother mentally. And then in the second set, she only like picks up speed. Like I think at the Australian Open, she that was how she beat Azarenka, like really tight, close, high quality first set. And then the second set, she just like loosened up even more, started hitting the ball even harder, and Azarenka had no chance. I mean, she was up two breaks at the end of the second set. Sabalenka got one of them back, but it was too late for it to matter.
Yeah, and Rybakina didn't even serve that well, like in the first set, like, or actually throughout the whole match, her first serve percentage was quite low. It was like 52%.
Yeah.
But then, you know, every single time that she made a first serve, she really made it count. Like, I feel like her plus one ball was really strong. And a lot of the times she was, and Sabalenka, I think, probably should have been done a little bit better in that department once she did make the first serve, because she did make her first serves a lot more often, but she just wasn't quite getting that same purchase. And I think I just feel like the double fault thing was very mental and kind of creeped into other parts of her game and her ground strokes, that in a game of this small margins against Rybakina, she just wasn't able to have that clear head like she did at in the Australian Open, where I think she only had 2 double faults in the last 2 sets after hitting 5%.
One of them on championship point.
Yeah, so there you go. Like, yeah, that was a bit unfortunate for her, but like Rybakina, I think throughout this tournament was just like against Swiatek, she was just absolutely flawless. And that was, you know, I was at that match live and I just thought, okay, like Rybakina's level has to drop at some point. There's no way she can't sustain this. And she did, like, throughout the whole time. I think from start to finish, that was probably her best match of the year so far.
And it's a high bar, too. I think you nailed it with the small margins. Like, yeah, you can say that Sabalenka made a few mistakes, but at the same time, when she beat Rybakina at the Australian Open, the last 2 sets were absolute peak Sabalenka. And so I think what this match tells you is, like, she kind of has to be at her absolute peak if she wants to beat Rybakina. Like, if you're missing that, like, 5-10%, then Rybakina is going to, like, punish you pretty effectively. That Świątek match, like, you know, Iga mentioned a rib issue after the match. It's impossible to know how much that had an effect. Certainly, it did have an effect. But, I mean, 6-2, 6-2? And Świątek was destroying everyone before that. I mean, she beat Andreescu in straights. That's a really good match. She destroyed Raducanu. And she just can't hold serve against Rybakina. Like, at the Australian Open, too, she was up 3-0 in the second set and lost at 6-4. And this is what I mean about Rybakina being, like, such a ruthless returner. Like, she's going to kill those second serves, like, every time.
And I was watching this match live, and I was thinking, like, okay, you know, surely Iga can get it out of Rybakina's strike zone. But as soon as I found out that the match was at night, I was like, okay, that's trouble. Because Rybakina, because the ball doesn't bounce as high at night, you know, and it stays lower and it's even slower. And that just gives Rybakina more time to connect. And she's not gonna, and she's gonna, you know, obviously hold her own on serve, and she's gonna win so many free points even against the Swiatek return. So I just thought, okay, this is like Swiatek has to zone in and just be like perfect, right, from the word go. And it just like didn't happen. The moment she got broken, I feel like mentally Swiatek just completely went away. And it was really unlike anything I'd seen before, to where, like, you know, she loses that first set 6-2. I thought, okay, at 2-5, if she can hold her serve here, you know, maybe she has a chance of getting back into this. But when she lost her serve,
she got one break back, right? At one
point. Yeah, that was at the end. That was at the second set where it was about to be a deagle. So it was really, really uncompetitive. Like, I thought, okay, you know, Swiatek would have a plan B. She could probably, you know, mix things up a little bit more. She was trying to outhead Rybakina, and I just don't think that was a good strategy at all. And the Rip thing is interesting because I did see her, you know, she seemed to move quite well in the beginning of the match, where she had two spectacular, like, backhand passing shots. And that was to get break point to get the break back. Like, I think it was 3-1, Rybakina serving, and Swiatek was able to get it to break point, like, didn't break that game. But I was like, okay, this is still, like, you know, she can be in this. And then she was not in it for, like, 30 minutes. And Rybakina just pulled totally ahead, and I just felt like it was extremely mental, and it was strange. I mean, that's kind of been the story of Swiatek this year. Like, she's either winning easily or losing easily. So it's not, we haven't really seen that kind of resistance. Like, that's what made her US Open run so impressive. Like, because she was not at her best for, like, most of those matches in that tournament. Like, she was down a set in a break against Niemeyer. She was down in the, you know, and then at times in the second set against Jabeur in the final. She was down 2-4 in the third against Sabalenka, but she came back and she had extra gears. But something about Swiatek's mentality right now, when other players are stepping up, I just feel like she's lost a little bit of what she had last year. And she could still get it back. And maybe the rib issue, like, did play a role then. You know, it's impossible to really tell. Like, I don't know, you know, exactly how much of a factor it played. But certainly that was jarring to see her, like, not have a plan B, I think.
I think part of it could just be, like, kind of the experience and career arc she's had so far. Like, her first Roland Garros title, she dominated. Like, there's basically not a single moment of adversity during that. And then during the entire streak, there was, like, maybe one or two scrappy wins, right? Like, early that year when she had that Australian Open match against Konecki, I remember thinking, like, oh, this is great for her because she won with her C game. Like, this is going to be so good going forward. But then, like, she didn't need her C game for the next, like, 5 months or whatever. So, like, maybe she's just not really used to this yet. Like, she's still super young, and, like, she's been on tour for a few years, and it's not as dramatic as, like, Raducanu having, like, never played a three-setter until, like, pretty recently. I don't know. I think it's tough to get used to, and especially since she can beat almost everyone on tour so easily. I think when those 2-3-4 bad matchups come up, it's kind of difficult to know what to do. I mean, against Rybakina, my suggestion would sort of, like you said, she has to zone. But, like, low margin aggression is not her thing. Like, she's built a 3-major title career on high margin aggression. And so I think when you're forced to do something else, it's extremely difficult because it's not what you are, you know? It's like with, Nadal Djokovic is not the same thing as Rybakina Swiatek, like, very different matchups. But it's like when Djokovic was beating Nadal constantly, and it's like everyone is saying, like, yeah, Nadal has to hit his forehand like a foot from the line. Like, that's not what Nadal did to become the player he was. And it took him a really long time to start doing that because I think it's such a fundamental, well, fundamental is the wrong word. It's such, like, an adjustment to, like, your identity as a player almost. And so I think that's really difficult for someone to do, sort of like Murray being more aggressive too. It's like, everyone has been pleading with him to be more aggressive for years, but, like, that's not what he is. It's not what he's ever been. It's like changing a piece of who you are, I guess. And so I think this is not to say that Swiatek won't ever be able to make these adjustments, but yeah, I think it's really tough. Like, when you play a certain way and that's good enough to beat, like, 95% of your opponents, it's really hard to change that.
Yeah, and now she's coming up against players who I think have more belief, and they're not scared of her, and they have the kind of weapons with the big strike and big serve to, like, take advantage of someone and just rush her. Like, and she looked rushed for most of the match, and she was kind of hitting forehands, like, on her back foot, and it was mainly the forehand that broke down quite a bit. Like, the backhand was still kind of hanging in for some points, but she just wasn't able to, like, normally she's able to get on that baseline and just move you side to side and just ruthlessly put you away, but against Rybakina. Rybakina just refused to get in those exchanges, and it just felt like, I mean, even in the Australia match, every time Swiatek was able to get like that baseline rhythm and extend rallies and kind of use her good footwork and like her ability to defend and, you know, get back to neutral, there she was at least even or winning like majority of rallies that went over 9 shots. And in this match, it's like none of the rallies even went there, and when they did, Swiatek just didn't have that rhythm or confidence because Rybakina just took it away from her. She just stripped her of time, basically. And that's really hard to do on a slow court, but Rybakina was so flawless throughout. And Rybakina just seems so unfazed. Like, every time she plays these matches, it's like just completely ice cold, like, under pressure. Just gives you nothing. Like,
yeah. There's nothing. She could play in, like, a... She could play in a hurricane, and, like, her expression would not change any more than it does now. And yeah, I do think the problem for Swiatek is, like, now the blueprint is out there, right? Like, you know you have to crush the ball, take away her time. You know the forehand is not that dangerous when it doesn't have time to load up. You know the serve is going to be vulnerable. And, like, now, as we've seen, there are multiple players who can kind of execute that game plan. As difficult as it
I would say there's still only, like, three. Like, I would say, like, she's still, you know, she's still a tier one player. Like, there's still her.
Oh, absolutely.
Rybakina, Sabalenka, and Krejcikova. I feel like those are just the three, right? Like, I mean,
well, and Krejcikova is a little different too because she's not as hard of a hitter. I think with her, it's more going toe to toe with Swiatek at her own game. But you know, now that you mentioned tiers, who do you think is the best player in the world on the WTA right now? I think you know, obviously Swiatek is still ranked number one. She's like not losing early anywhere. I don't even know if it's like her form has dipped really, but Rybakina's beaten her twice. We've now had two massive Sabalenka-Rybakina finals. Do either one of them have an argument as being the best player in the world?
I think I would still go with Sabalenka just because she won the Australian Open. She did. Her only loss before this was Krejcikova, who won Dubai, and even that match, she bageled Krejcikova. So, and then in this tournament, yeah, like Rybakina beat her, but she won the more important match in the Australian Open final. So I still think it's probably, you just have to go by the race, and I just think it's Sabalenka, Rybakina, and then Swiatek probably, and then I think you still have to put Krejcikova in there. I think it was unfortunate, though, that Krejcikova was playing Sabalenka the fourth round because her ranking is, you know, not there, and I think the same thing will happen in Miami, so maybe that result will flip or something, but we'll see, because, like, Krejcikova, that was one of the best runs I've ever seen to a Masters or a WTA 1000 title. Like, she beat 5 players in the top 15. It was crazy. So,
yeah, it's interesting. Like, I think, so I do think Swiatek still has an argument just because, like, I think on the clay, it's going to be that much harder to beat her. Like,
yeah,
don't really see Rybakina doing it because movement is going to play so much more of a factor. I think Sabalenka will also have a tougher time. Would love to see
the only thing about the clay, though, for the WTA, the only thing about the clay for the WTA is I feel like apart from Roland Garros and maybe Rome, like, the big hitters will still have a chance in the other tournaments. Just because you have the altitude. Stuttgart is indoors.
Yep.
Houston is green clay, which is just plays completely different. And then you have, like, the other smaller tournaments, which most of these players are probably not going to play. But it just feels like Roland Garros is, like, the main one. Like, I don't... Rybakina has actually made a quarterfinal at Roland Garros, and she did beat Serena in 2021.
So yeah.
And it does have a great
tournament. Did she play Swiatek that tournament, too?
I don't think so. I think she I definitely remember her losing in the quarters, because I know she beat Serena in the third round. I was trying to think who did she lose to in the quarters. I think it was probably Jinkola.
It
was like one of those 9-7 in the thirds matches.
Yeah, there were a lot of those that tournament.
Yeah, I think it was probably Jinkova, and then probably Jinkova ended up getting to the final. And that seems like a match she could have won, because went down all the way down to the wire.
That's true. I do think at Roland Garros, like, the big one, there are more favorable conditions for Swiatek, but even there, it's still best of three. So
I'm
not saying that, like, she's a lock to win, but and Rybakina is great on grass too, and Sabalenka is pretty good on grass. So I think they have kind of an all surface thing going. I think Rybakina's got an argument for it too.
Honestly,
like, Australian Open finalist, Wimbledon champion, depending on how she does on the clay. Now Indian.
But it's a good question, because, like, if you looked at the WTA last year, it was kind of a lot more unstable and chaotic because of like because Barty was leaving, and then you had, you know, you had Collins in there who kept getting injured, and you had Bedosa who was in good form at the time, but then she got injured and kind of fell off a little bit, and then you had Kontaveit, same kind of story. But now I feel like you look at this race, or you look at the race on the WTA right now, and it's like, okay, this feels legit. Like, this feels like the top four players right now. And then you also have a really nice group of, like, tier two people with, like, Pagula and Goff and Sakkari, and these are all, like you could see them at the WTA finals. Like, you could see this, like, continuing, like, for the rest of the year. And it doesn't feel like anyone can just win these tournaments. It feels like there's a group of maybe eight players now, and maybe more like four or five, but...
Yeah, and you're going to have to go through a few of the others to win as well. Yeah, I mean Rybakina beat Świątek and Sabalenka. So
yeah,
clearly Sabalenka.
And then there's also players like Andreescu, who's like, if her form is anything to go by, like, she's improving. Raducanu is improving. Fernandez, I think, can improve as well.
Yeah, and I think she will.
I think Mukova, I mean, if she just stays healthy, like, she's really dangerous too. Almost beat Rybakina in the quarterfinals here. Yeah. So I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great time. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to still say Świątek is the best player in the world just because she's still got that number one ranking. Like, she's still probably not going to.
She still has a sizable lead, like around 3,000 points or something, because she was so good last year.
Right.
And I still think she'll defend most of that on the clay because, I just think the French Open is going to be a different story, but.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, there are those two, three players who, like, can beat her and have done it, like, multiple times pretty recently. So it's, like, I think she's going to have to make adjustments. She's already not as dominant at number one as she was last year, which I think is, like, good for the tour. Not that, like, having her be so dominant was a bad thing. I think that was amazing to watch. But we're getting rivalries now, which I think is fantastic. Like, after the Australian Open... I think everyone was saying, like, I'd already love to see a rematch of this final. We got one already with a different result. So I think that introduces some more intrigue to the matchup. Because this was Rybakina's first win over Sabalenka too, right?
Yeah, this was her first win. And all the previous matches before were three-setters, but all won by Sabalenka, so...
Yeah, I think that's great to have, because now you know it can go either way. I'm super excited to see what happens next. I mean, like, can you imagine how... chaotic's the wrong word, but, like, how many people are going to have a shot at the U.S. Open?
I could see a lot of... Like, that's usually the one that's the most open anyway. But, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, that could... Like, if there's going to be any kind of, like, an underdog story or, like, or anything close to what we had in 2021, it will probably still be that slam. For sure.
For sure. But it's also, like, you have so many players who are so good on hard court right now.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's just going to be, like, an amazing battle royale between... like, sort of like that set of, like, eight players like you were talking about. I just hope everyone stays healthy.
And I do sort of like that, like, you know, Goff is really consistent, Pagula is really consistent, Sakkari is really consistent. So at least you kind of know what you're getting from those three right now. And then, you know, if you have these four, or, you, like, if you want to win any tournament right now, you have to go through at least two or three of them. So.
Yeah. It's... I'm really excited for both tours, to be honest. I won't do my Sunshine Double rant right now, but I'm excited for the clay to start, just because then we're building to a major again. And we can sort of see who positions themselves well for that, and then who can make the most of their momentum. I think Alcaraz and Świątek are still, like, carrying the torches as, like, the, you know, magnetic young stars on both tours. I think they're bringing a lot of ice to the sport, and we'll continue doing that. I think we're in a good place right now.
Yeah. I think so too. Yeah, I mean, overall, I feel like, you know, on paper, a lot of these matchups looked good, like, before they started, particularly the quarterfinals onwards. And they didn't, like, all plan out to be really good, high quality, or, like, we didn't get that many three-setters. Mm-hmm. But, like, we got a lot of data from this, where I feel like, you know, this, like, really tells the story of, like, where we're at every year. And because this tournament, you know, in March, it's, like, kind of isolated. Like, Indian Wells and Miami are, like, their own thing, like, 2 weeks each.
Right.
Like, you know, like you said, like, not really leading up to a slam. Like, it just kind of feels like all the spotlight is on here, like, in America for tennis at once at this moment. So I'm glad to see, because, like, Indian Wells, That place was packed. Like in the first weekend, I think there were like 45,000 people on that Saturday. I could barely get in. It was crazy. And I think some of that is like the Alcaraz effect. Some of that is like how the tournament is marketed. Some of that is like how great the facility is and like how fan friendly it is and how much the players love it and all of that. And that's why, like, man, it just takes like front and center stage. And then you just go to Miami and it's like, it's a similar kind of feel. Like at one point that was called the Fifth Slam. And then now this has been called the Fifth Slam for like over 15 years. And it's like, I think it's like not actually, like, I don't actually personally believe it's a Fifth Slam, but I do think it's like,
it's an honor with the best. Title, but like, you see why it has it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you can kind of see like why it has that sort of bigger appeal. It's almost like Disneyland, like, you know, how they say it's like the happiest place on earth. That's like how they market this tournament.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm glad you got to go. I saw you got some photos with like some pretty awesome people. You got Loanda, Rob Laver, like,
yeah, that was wild, because like I was just, you know, me and Peter were just eating lunch, and Peter's not allowed to get for those of our listeners who don't know, Peter is one of the hosts of Brain Musings, and he actually works at the tournament as a logger, and like behind the scenes he does the stats and for logs on the scores for these matches, like in the booth. And he and I were just eating lunch. And then out of nowhere, we just see like Rod Laver just walking on the lawn. And we're just like, and he's going up to Lindsay Davenport and their family, because they were eating lunch next to us. And so I'm like, Peter, like, should I go up? You know, should I introduce myself? You know, this guy is like, you know, basically the father of tennis. Like, should I just, you know, what should I say to him, Peter? And then, you know, he's like, just go for it. I believe in you. You can do it, you know? I just went up to him, and he had like two agents next to him, you know? They were like, you know, just walk, we're in a hurry, like, you know, just come walk with us. And then I think like there were like three people who had just ran ahead of me and got selfies. And then I was just like, okay, I need to at least say hi, even if I don't get a picture, you know? I thought I finally, you know, I was able to get a picture, and he was really nice. And then I told him like, thank you for everything you've done for tennis, because he kind of paved the way for all the generation that we love to watch. So That was awesome. That was maybe the highlight of my trip. Like,
yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if kickstarted is the right word, but he like had a big hand in like the open era, like being a thing.
Like, yeah, last guy to do the, you know, calendar slam. So,
yeah,
and much more than that. But yeah, so
yeah, but better than Novak Djokovic as 2021 proof, right?
I mean, he's the original GOAT, right? I mean,
right.
We can just annoy all the Big Three fan base at once. Like, it's
Well, I mean, number one on Jeff Sackman's tennis 128 list, right?
Yeah, there you go. The perfect metric.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that. That's a topic for another time.
Yeah, that's yes.
Any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
No. What would you say is like your favorite? Was your like favorite moment of this tournament? Like, do you have one?
That's a good question. I wasn't able to sit down and watch as many matches as I might have liked. I think
the time zone was really tricky for you as well.
I feel like I watched some more stuff early on. Honestly, just watching Alcaraz do his thing is pretty awesome. Like, it's a boring answer, but I'm just so glad he's healthy. Like, when he's racing around the court, his highlight reels always, I think, poke a little further out of that tennis bubble than the average one when they go around on Twitter. I'm glad he's back. How about you?
Yeah, for me, one is like, I actually didn't get to watch Carlos courtside, but for me, it might have been, what was it for me? Okay, yeah, this is like really random, but I watched Kvitova versus Ostapenko.
Yeah, that was
in honor of this podcast, you know. In honor of this podcast, I have to choose that one because
two bagels,
two bagels back to back. When do you ever see that, you know? And then all of a sudden, you know, Kvitova goes up 4-love in the third set, and then takes, and then Ostapenko takes a medical timeout and like gets her temperature checked, and it was like, you know, we were like, are you like just doing this to bring the momentum? Because that's what it feels like. And then Kvitova wins the next four games, and then she takes a medical timeout. And then we're just like, okay, so now that we don't get 6-love, 6-6 love with our final scoreline or whatever it is, we need to get this to a tiebreak. And then we need the tiebreak score to be 7-0. And then we'll have the best scoring image of all time, you know? Yeah. Pan out that way. Kvitova won 6-4. She played amazing the next two games. But we just got to see something like so crazy when like two, because they have both these two players were like slam champions, were like basically a red line to win their majors, and they can't play together at the same time. So watching one of them for the other was just amazing and equally like jarring at the same time.
Emblematic score line. Like,
yeah.
That's fantastic. I mean, Kvitova's run was super fun too. But she had all those match point saves against Pegula too.
That was crazy. That was really impressive. Like, she finished it off with like a serving volley, and then she had like these ridiculous forehands to like save match points. Like, I don't think Pegula did anything wrong in those match points. Kvitova just redlined a net forehand winners.
Yeah, and I think Pegula was like pretty chill after it too. Like, wasn't annoyed or anything. They had a nice exchange at the net. I love it when that happens. But yeah, I mean, really fun tournament. Excited for Miami, and then it's play. So I will try not to take as long of a hiatus as I did before this podcast for my next one. But we'll talk again soon for sure.
Yeah, it was really fun recapping. And for listeners, they can follow you at Tennis Nation, right? That's your handle, and also Popcorn Tennis.
Yep.
Check out all the good pieces over there. Then you can follow me at Rodri2K. You can follow Andre at Rollenberg Andre, and you can follow us at Tennis and Beatles Official, which is our Twitter name. And I think that's about it. And if you have any questions or you want to get more questions of yours answered, or you have anything you want to let us know about these episodes, then feel free to DM us, and we'll always be available. And I'm actually doing an episode with Steve Flink on Tuesday. So,
all right. Excited for that.
I'm excited for that. So keep an eye out for that. And then, and other shows as well. And then obviously we'll do a Miami recap too. So, cheers wherever you are in the world, this thing. And thanks, Owen, for coming on.
Yeah, of course. Again, hopefully I'll be on again sooner than after that long break. But see you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.